all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your hosts for today's program, Dale Thronberry and Bob Gould.
And good evening, America. Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am your host today, Bob Gould, and I'm really excited. See, I just introduced you, Bob. So
I'm here, and I'm in the control room. Right, Nina's somewhere else and doing her...
She's visiting family in Texas.
Oh, okay.
So it's not a problem. We want to welcome everybody to Veterans Radio today. Again, my name is Dale Thronberry, and I will be your host. We're very excited. We're going to be talking about current events, of course, going on around the world with the terrorist movements. Our guest today is Bing West. I can't wait to have Bing on the program and talk to him.
This guy knows
everything everywhere, so we're very excited to have him on. But before we do that, I've got a couple of announcements to make. Number one, I got an email from a good friend of ours, Richard Sidnick, up in upstate New York, New York Mills, New York, and they have an organization up there called Feed Our Vets. And I want you to go to their website, it was called Feed Our Vets, and check it out, because they just have a generous sponsor or supporter who's going to match your donations to this organization. In fact, up to $50,000. So if you guys out there can go to Feed Our Vets and make a contribution to them, they have a sponsor out there that's going to match your donation up to $50,000. There's a possibility of $100,000 that they can do. And they do a great job up there in northwestern New York State, helping veterans, feeding veterans, clothing veterans, finding jobs, so on and so forth. So make sure that you do that. See if you can help them out. I think that's a great opportunity. I want to remind our audience out there also that you can follow Veterans Radio on Twitter and also on Facebook. And you can give us a call during the program if you have a question for Bing. Our number here in Southeast Michigan is 734-822-1600, 734-822-1600, or we'll pay for it, toll-free, 844-838-1600. That's 844-VET-1600. So, Bob, we also have some other news, don't you?
Talked
to somebody
this
week.
Very exciting news. We are, by the way, folks, if you would like to contribute to Veterans Radio for the 2015 broadcasting year, please go to our website. All the information's on there. It's like we're doing our own GoFundMe, right?
Right.
Yeah. And all that money goes into production costs that we raise. And if you go to our website, you'll see all the information. What you get for that is be our book, Vietnam Stories, the Best of Veterans Radio. That's complimentary for your contribution of $25 or more. All the information available on our website. Now, we do have another sponsor, Dale. Conway, yeah. Conway Trucking. Hit it, Chuck. Conway Truckload honors the service of American military men and women with an apprenticeship program that allows veterans to use the GI Bill to supplement their income during their first year driving, as well as tuition reimbursement when they begin. Conway Truckload wants to continue the tradition of service right here at home. To learn more, call 866-WORK-FOR-US or visit online true2blue.com/military.
That's all right. That's just the practice. So we're going to be talking about Conway Freight. I don't know about you, but I see Conway Freight trucks all over the eastern part of the United States. I don't get too far west. But my understanding of this program is that they will hire you, train you, put you to work, and
that's a great deal.
Utilizing your GI Bill money can help with your training and reimbursement for anything that goes along there, and also supplement your income for the first year. And the other thing is that if you... if you have military experience, already have your CDL license, then you can earn a little
extra. But that's not necessary, because they'll do all that.
That's right. They'll train you, but you could earn a little extra money.
You know, and by the way, folks, I want to make a difference between Conway Trucking and Conway Freight. They're both the same company, so why'd they do that? Well, one's an over-the-road, the other one's a P&D, pickup and delivery more. But we're going to be talking about Conway Trucking, the over-the-road, your home on the weekend. Man, it's really a great deal. Conway Trucking, you want to go to their website. Here we go. which is TrueToBlue.com/military. TrueToBlue.com/military. All the information's on there. It's really quite a deal, Dale.
No,
you know, and they were talking about, in the free press, about the top 10 jobs in Michigan, and driving was right there within the top 10. They happened to mention Conway, but that was just as an aside. But it's one of the 10 most exciting jobs for 2015 here in the state of Michigan. Isn't that cool?
I think it's very cool. If I was about 20 years younger, I'd think about it myself.
I mean, we're talking even six figures.
That's a lot of dough.
That's more than I make in a week.
So we encourage them to... Yeah, how many nickels makes up six figures, right? So we're saying if you go to their TrueBlue.com/military, there's more information there.
Oh, everything.
And also you can give Conway a call at 866-WORK-4-US. That's work, the number for us, and there'll be more information there for you. Right now we're going to hear that commercial one more time, and then we're going to come right back with Bing West.
Okay. Go ahead, Dale. We are going to go right, definitely, let's just go right into Bing.
Okay.
So Derek, can we go right into Bing?
That.
Yeah, he's shaking his head. Go ahead. Fire away.
Okay. Well, our guest today on Veterans Radio is our good friend Bing West. And this guy's resume is amazing. Anyway, he's been a guest on Veterans Radio. He's written over 10 books about war and close-in battle. He's a graduate of Georgetown and Princeton Universities. In Vietnam, he was a member of the Marine Force Reconnaissance Team that initiated Operation Stingray. These were attacks behind enemy lines in the jungle. He also understands high-level strategy. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense under President Reagan. He chaired the United States Security Commission with El Salvador, Morocco, Egypt, Jordan, Pakistan, South Korea, and Japan. When we bring on Bing, we get the facts, and this is what I love about talking with him the most. So, Bing West, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Thank you.
So how are things out on the East Coast?
A bit cold, a bit nippy right up here in Newport, Rhode Island.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's right. Where are we going to be, Bob? Massachusetts in January?
Sandwich,
sure. That's down on the Cape. When are you going there?
Well, we're working on that.
Looks
right
like
now we're looking at
toward the end of June.
Father's Day.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And
okay.
Of course, you're invited, Bing. And it's going to be a clam bake for Korean War veterans in the American Legion over there at Sandwich. Wow,
that'll be terrific. I see you're not penguins, though. You're not going to do it in February.
No.
Now we have enough time up here in Michigan, even
exactly.
Going outside right now. The reason that I asked Bing to be on the program, again, reminding our audience, if you have a question for Bing, you can give us a call here at 734-822-1600 or 844-838-1600, is because of what occurred in France last week and what occurred in Belgium last week and what's occurring in Algeria and Morocco and everywhere else. So let's start with France. What's going on over there that you're aware of?
Well, let me basically say that I don't get that excited about this, Dale. I mean, it's the number of people that are killed in car accidents and other things is much greater. What I think people find really bothersome about this, if they think about it for a moment, it's the uncertainty of knowing if there are members of your own country who want to kill you. And, you know, that's what's repulsive to people. But we are going to have these Islamist jihadists around for at least the next 10 years until this burns itself out.
But I was reading an article in, The Economist, actually, and it's talking about just the threat of terrorism is increasing while the ability of Western security agencies to defeat it is declining. It seems like, as you mentioned, because these aren't these big, you know, multi-people being killed, that people aren't paying as much attention to it. And so these men and women, and more women, are being able to come in and out, it seems, of these countries and, you know, go and get their training in Yemen or wherever it happens to be. Then they come home and they're let back in and they can do whatever it is that they want to do.
Well, I think you hit high water marks with this kind of stuff too, though. You know, France has its own kinds of problems, et cetera. But if you look here in the United States, I mean, really the record is absolutely extraordinary.
It is phenomenal.
We have not been hit since 9/11. I mean, it's quite remarkable.
That is amazing. I mean, we've had, you know, the incidents, you know, down in Texas and so forth, but they don't seem to be organized or affiliated with any real organization overseas.
Which indicates really how difficult it is to strike in America, because you don't have a ghetto that's radicalized. That just doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very hard. People think, oh, you can hide among 300 million people. It turns out to be very hard to hide among 300 million people.
So this reminded me of a thought I have. You know, we have the largest Arab American population about 10 miles down the road from us here in Dearborn, and there have been no issues there. In fact, I think that maybe it's just in America it's so much easier to assimilate into our population.
Well, it is, and actually Dearborn has produced many of the best translators that we have had in the war in Iraq.
I completely that. I've had a couple of students that have come through and said, oh, I'm going into the Army to be a translator. And I said, oh.
Exactly.
And that's what they do. I think they really appreciate what we do here. It sounds like in France that they have, you know, even though they have such an influx of Muslim moving into France, that they are isolating them and putting them into these little villages that are turning into, you know, ghettos almost.
Well, I don't want to speak ill of any other country, but I mean, our country doesn't have to take a second seat to anyone in the world in terms of assimilating everybody and just saying, okay, you want to be American? Fine, you're an American, and that's the end of it.
Takes a little work sometimes, even for us to do that. So let's go back over to the Middle East and see what's going on in there. Do you think that the main issue in the Middle East right now is Syria and ISIS?
The main issue is a lack of leadership against the Islamists. And the problem is President Obama clearly does not want to be in this war.
Mm-hmm.
And he has alienated Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, to a large extent Jordan. So it's hard to say, where are you going to find the leader? And if it isn't the United States, what Islamic leader is going to stand up? And the only way this is going to end, Dale, is when some Muslim leader stands up, not a Christian leader. You know, it has to be, in the end, that there will come out of this eventually somebody like Ataturk or Sadat. I mean, this has to play out in the end, that you have an Islamic leader who basically says, this is wrong, I'm going to take back that territory. And we haven't seen that kind of person emerge yet. And unfortunately, the United States has alienated these countries. And therefore, it's hard for us to say to them, we're behind you 100%, because they know we're not.
Right. Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, you know, some promises have not been kept. As we're
correct.
Aware of.
I mean, we intend, you either get on one side or the other. Eventually, in Egypt, which is the key, and has been the key country in Arab Muslim lands, we had a solid backer in Mubarak. And when the April uprising started, we didn't quite know what to do, and then we finally said, Mubarak has to go. But we ended up with an Islamist party that went too far, and when the military in Egypt overthrew the Islamist party, we were stuck in that the Islamist party no longer liked us, and the military no longer liked us, so we were left out in the cold. And the same thing happened with Saudi Arabia. We've been trying to cut this deal with Iran, and as a result, the Saudis are very suspicious of us. So we're in a position where we don't have that much leverage.
Wow. I'm looking at this map that I printed off to see where the distribution was of Muslims around the world, and you know, the Sunnis versus the Shias and so forth. And the Middle East is almost entirely authoritarian governments, and there's very few. There's a couple of experiments going on over there with Turkey and a couple of those other ones. Is that, do you feel that's a big part of it, because it is so authoritarian?
I can't get in the minds of, I have a hard time keeping my own mind straight, let alone getting into the minds of others. You know, we like to think in those terms as Americans. I'm not persuaded one way or the other about that. All I know is that I divide the world more into those who are our allies and those who are our enemies and those who are on the fence. And I would say what you said about Turkey, Turkey's an example. I'm very wary of the Prime Minister of Turkey, Erdogan, because he's becoming more and more saying that he's Islamic. He really isn't helping us, nor should he in a way, but he's not really helping anybody. It's like he's hoping when this all ends that Turkey becomes the strong man in the Islamic Middle East as it was in the Ottoman Empire. So I'm not a big cheerleader for what I see going on in Turkey.
You wrote a book entitled The Strongest Tribe, which is one of our favorite explanations of what was going on in Iraq. And we see Iraq, you know, trying to pull themselves together, but they're losing territory and so forth. What's your view on Iraq today with their new prime minister?
I am very careful about this prime minister. I haven't seen him really do anything. Let's understand what's happened in Iraq. From Baghdad south, you have the oil fields and the money, and they're all Shia. And Baghdad and the Shia militias have invited in Iran. So the Iranian generals and soldiers are there fighting alongside the Shiites against the Sunnis in this crazy group of ISIS. And we're over there. And I keep asking people, well, why is this in our best interest if Iran are the real advisors and we're the guys behind the wire who aren't allowed to be in the battle? Do we think when this ends that Iraq is going to come together again as one country? I don't think it is. And yet that's our policy. But the problem is that the prime minister, who's Shiite, and he promised to be nicer to the Sunnis, who have been taken over by these radicals called ISIS, but his promises are running hollow. He is not doing anything. The Sunnis have no place to go, and nobody is really helping them. And all the aid that we're sending, we are sending through Baghdad. So the Sunnis don't get anything from us. They only get it from the Shiites in Baghdad. And that, and the same is true of the Kurds. That, to me, is a bad American policy.
Bob had a question you wanted to answer.
Yeah, Bing. Hey, Bob. And this is Bob Gould, by the way.
Yep.
And
yep.
Welcome
Thank
to
you.
The program. We have ISIS. ISIS now has Iran. The Sunnis, there we are, and are they not the enemy, the Sunnis? Why do we want to help them?
This is always the dilemma we get into. It's the ISIS, the Sunni radicals are the ISIS group. They're the Islamists. They're the terrorists. They may be only 5% of the population, and they have the rest of them cowed. The reason that things went well for us in 2008 in Iraq, when General Petraeus was over there with the surge, etc., was actually that the Sunnis, whom we had been fighting, came over to our side. That's why in my book it said the strongest tribe. They came over to the side of the strongest tribe, believing that we would help them have some freedom from the majority Shiites that we had put in power when we threw out Saddam. But then we left. President Obama decided to leave entirely. And those Sunnis then were oppressed by the Shiite government. And that's when these radicals came in and took over. Now we're going back in a little bit at a time, and we say we're still on the side of the government, the Shiite government, but the Shiite government is going to be different. They're going to change their spots. Yeah. I don't believe it.
I think about Iraq and talking with all the soldiers and as you have, you know, and Marines and so forth about, you know, they're going in, you know, we're putting our lives on the line, and the Iraqis can't seem to step up and take charge of their own country. And what, you know, what we did to the Sunnis when we first went into Iraq, you know, got them all, you know, threw them all out of government, threw them out of the army, and threw them out of everything else, and put all the Shias in, and now we can't figure out what was wrong?
Correct. We screwed it up to a fairly well. We really did. And both presidents did. I mean, I was equally opposed when President Bush was saying that we owed liberty to other people. It sent a shudder through me because you cannot owe liberty.
No.
You cannot give freedom as a gift. You can't. And we overthrew Saddam and the Sunnis and put in the Shiites. Well, what did we expect was going to happen? So it's a mess, and President Obama clearly does not want to get involved in this, and therefore it will just continue to smolder along. But I'll come all the way back to my beginning. I don't see it as being that big a deal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are in Africa, my goodness, at certain points over the last 10 or 20 years, 500,000 people in one country were slaughtered by others in the same country, and we knew very little about it and just ignored it. So, you know, I hate to be callous about it, but we can't go around being the world's policeman. Sometimes we just have to let people kill each other.
That's a sad state of affairs. That's for
well, but it's been going on since Cain and Abel walked the face of the earth.
I know that, and I'm just naive enough to not think that we should be letting these things happen around the world. But then again, you know, I don't want my son to have to go fight another war that, you know, that the politicians get us into, and they haven't really figured out exactly what we're going to do once we get there. And oh, by the way, okay, now we're going to get out. And, they're collapsing again. Here's this country that was put together by the English after, what, World War One, and I don't know. It's like I'm trying to even think of an analogy of how the populations of these countries can feel that they can ever pull themselves up by their bootstraps and take control, because they always seem to be overrun or controlled by despots and, you know, corruption and everything else that's out there. And I don't know how that culture, that part of that culture, can ever change.
Well, but Dale, I mean, I think if you stood back from a wall map of the world and just took darts and blindfolded yourself and then flung 10 darts, there 7 of those 10 darts would end up in countries where you would shudder and say, oh boy, am I glad I don't live there. So that's just the human condition.
I know, but don't you want to fix it?
No, I don't.
No, I understand it. It's just like, you know, I mean, you were in Vietnam, and we saw what happened there, and it appears
and
like they're
finally... I've spent years in Iraq, and I've spent years in Afghanistan.
I know. I want to get to Afghanistan after our break.
Of all three of those, I would have helped the Vietnamese more than either of these other countries.
There was a big difference there, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. The Vietnamese were much more likable. They would interact with you.
Yeah.
Look, the Arab Muslims have a tradition. You are not allowed in their houses. You're not allowed to see their women. It's a different civilization. That's just a fact. The Vietnamese were more open, and we let the Vietnamese down. If we had continued to give them aid, I think they could have survived, but we didn't.
No.
So we move on.
Well, we do move on, and we're talking with Bing West right now, and we kind of try to figure out what was going on in Iraq and Syria and Turkey. We've got about 2 minutes before we get to the bottom of the hour. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, you can give us a call here at 734-822-1600. You can send us an email at to dale@veteransradio.net, and we'll answer your questions for you. What do you see happening in Syria? Is this thing just going to continue smoldering, or is it going to explode again and Assad will be finally gone?
I really wish I could answer that kind of question, because then I could figure out where to put my bets in the stock exchange and I'd be a millionaire. You know, I don't know whether if, say, he was assassinated, okay, which would be the most likely way. The question is, are we dealing just with Assad, or does he have an entire loyalty among a certain set of the population so that it goes much deeper than Assad? And I don't have the answer to that.
Okay. Well, what about one of your other books was The Wrong War, and this one you talk about Afghanistan. Let's get started a little bit on that.
Sure. My latest book on that is called 1 Million Steps, A Marine Platoon at War. And I just think we overstepped in Afghanistan.
Again. Again, right? We overstepped
again,
on the regular basis.
Look, 31 million tribal Afghans hurtling headlong into the 9th century, and every one of them, not every one of them, but a large majority out in the areas where they can, plants poppy, knowing that opium destroys other human beings. What are we doing trying to nation build there? The only thing we should have done was gone in to destroy Al-Qaeda, and we
didn't.
We let them escape.
Hold
that
thought.
Was all.
Hold
we
that thought.
Didn't have to stay there the way we did.
Hold that thought, Bing. We'll be right back at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We're back on Veterans Radio. We're talking with Bing West, a well-known author, award-winning author of books like The Strongest Tribe, The Wrong War, and now 1 Million Steps, A Marine Platoon at War. And we were talking just before the break about Afghanistan and where that country seems to be going, and I think the prime minister there is doing similar things that they were doing in Iraq that we talked about in the last segment. What do you think, Bing?
I don't see it as just being a prime minister anywhere or a president. It has to be an entire bureaucracy, and what's the drum to which they're moving. And what bothers me about Afghanistan is I do not see that they can hang on to all the territory that Americans cleared. So I do think that in many areas the Taliban will wash in again. I don't think the Taliban are powerful enough to take the cities. And if that's all it is, I could live with that.
Mm-hmm.
The big deal there is going to be that the Congress is going to have to give them about $6 to $10 billion a year for the next 10 years. And I know that in Congress, as what happened after Vietnam, is that the Congress said, "The heck with it! I'm not going to give them that money."
Right.
And so I think the biggest challenge is going to be, will Congress continue to give about $10 billion a year?
I don't know. You mentioned, before we took the break that that the main crop again in Afghanistan is opium.
Correct.
And that they can't seem to convert them over to another cash making, crop because there's not enough money to be made.
Oh, I don't go for that. Okay. Let me tell you what I think, which is very simple about this. And I spent an awful lot of time out in the countryside there. That country can grow anything. They can grow corn, they can grow tomatoes, they could even grow rice, but they can certainly grow all the wheat you could possibly imagine. It's not that the country is poor. It is that you can earn more money by poisoning other people's minds,
mm-hmm.
by So the entire society has decided to go against their own conscience in doing this. They know. I would estimate between 10 and 20% of those that you see in the countryside once you're outside the cities, they're gone. Their minds are gone. They are opium users. And so every single village knows that what they're doing is wrong, and they continue to do it.
That's kind of fascinating to me, and I guess, again, it's something that's not being reported by any.
Well, but that's, I mean, it's common sense when you think of it. We want to excuse them by saying, oh, they don't have enough money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, you know, look at in the inner cities. You know, the guy is hustling dope, and he says, man, it's the only way I can make money, and I only earn $50,000, $100,000 a year. Give me a break. And they're saying, in essence, the same thing. So, you want to make it legal everywhere in the world to let people poison their own minds. Go ahead, but that's a decision for the politicians to make. But those people know what they're doing. They know what they're doing is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Let's go across the border to Pakistan, where the Taliban is, trying to flex a little muscle there, and then they go off and they kill 100 kids at a school, and so now they're up, they can't figure out why the Pakistani army is going after them. What do you think will happen there?
Pakistan, the top levels in Pakistan pay no taxes, none. And they are used to running things, and the army is used to running things with this paranoia about India. And the leaders in Pakistan encouraged radical Islam because they believed it was a way in which they could keep power. Now they're on the back of a tiger, and they don't know what to do with it. And as far as I'm concerned, Pakistan brought this upon themselves, and they certainly did. But they have over 60 nuclear weapons. And so, ironically, they have this great blackmail against us. We will have to continue to help Pakistan, even though they're doing a terrible job, because we don't want to take the risk of any one of those nuclear weapons falling into the hands of these radicals whose rise in Pakistan is due to the duplicity of their own officers. So it's a real, real mess. I'm sorry to be so optimistic on these things.
Well, no. I mean, going back to what you even said at the very beginning of our conversation today, these people have to solve their own problems. So we can kind of, they talk about immigration in America and building these big walls around America to keep people out. It's almost like we got to build a big wall all the way around this civilization over there and let them fight it out and decide if they're going to join the rest of the world or if they're going to continue with, the track that they're following. I don't know how you're ever going to do that, but it just seems like we have to let them somehow figure it out on their own, and they don't seem to want to.
Well, the great irony is that no matter what we've done for Pakistan, and we've done a heck of a lot over the last 30 years for Pakistan, mm-hmm. They still, the elites still whip up the masses against us. So public opinion in Pakistan toward the United States is at an all-time low, something like only 15% of the population like us, and 85% are opposed to us, even though it's our aid that really keeps the country going. So it's very ironic. I think many of our top leaders have really had it with the duplicity of the Pakistani officials, but we just have to tolerate it. And there's, again, you manage these problems, and you don't get particularly upset about them. You just manage them.
I know, but it costs so much money to just manage.
No, it doesn't. No.
Not as much as fighting there, but.
We're not spending, I think maybe $7 billion, maybe, in Pakistan. I mean, where the money is, look, the biggest problem the United States has, by far, is ourselves. We have a mountain of debt that we have put upon our children to pay off that's going to require them to pay much higher taxes, because those of us who are older took that money. And I think that's the great disgrace of America that neither party nor President Obama will stand up to. The biggest problem we have isn't these. These are small problems overseas. We can manage them. We cannot manage our debt.
Well, there you heard it, folks. Now we're back here. We have our own problems. I agree with that. In fact, we were listening to the news as we were coming along, and I guess the president is going to propose some sort of tax on high-income people, and so now the, you know, the lines are being set in the proverbial sand, and, you know, no, we're not going to raise taxes on anybody. We're going to cut programs. And as you point out, it's going to be our grandchildren that are going to have to pay these debts off at some point in the future.
Well, the basic point is it isn't one program or another. It's Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and Obamacare. And everyone is going to have to take a little bit less. But President Obama is saying the exact opposite. He just won't stand up for the biggest problem we have. He won't. It's just a shame, a darn shame. Because the longer we don't try to get our debt under control, the worse it's going to be for the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone knows that. That's simple mathematics. You have to pay off your debt, and as the interest goes up, and it's eventually going to go up in another 2 or 3 or 4 years, then you're paying more of the entire budget of the United States and more of our taxes just to, because it's the interest on the debt that you owe.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone can see this cliff in front of them, and yet the Congress and the President, and I also blame the press to a large extent. The press is not pointing out how severe this problem is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, we can handle those things one way or the other. The debt is the big issue.
Well, the debt, you know, it's kind of like us as individuals, you know, if our interest or our debts are outweighing our income, what are we going to do? Something's going to have to give, and it's, you know, you give up cable, or you give up, get a smaller car, what are you going to do?
Exactly.
And it doesn't seem like anybody of the 535 people sitting down there in Washington right now that are willing to pull their belts in a little tight.
Now, I'd have to say I am impressed with this Congressman Ryan. I really think, you know, he gets it. He really understands it. He stands above everyone else in my judgment. But he's just one man, you know. But he certainly gets it. But I wish others would get it, too.
It would be nice. We're coming up on another break, and I'm going to go to the break a little bit early because I want you to, when we come back, I want to kind of go back to the Middle East, and I want to talk about Iran and what's up next with these guys.
Yep.
So we're going to take a break. We'll be right back after this message.
Living at American House is like being on a cruise ship, with all the lovely surroundings, the many, many activities, and the people to share with. It's so comfortable to be here. I feel safe. I don't have to shop. I don't have to cook. I don't have to clean up.
When you move into an American House senior living community, you open the door to a new world of possibilities. Our life enrichment directors are committed to enhancing the lives of residents every day. We look forward to finding out what interests you.
I just get dressed up and walk down to the dining room and enjoy my meals in the company of other people at my table.
For more moments made in American House, go to AmericanHouse.com. Again, that's AmericanHouse.com. Or watch us at YouTube.com/AmericanHouseLiving.
Living here has enriched my life. I'm Carol Huck, and I made in American House.
Conway Truckload honors the service of American military men and women with an apprenticeship program that allows veterans to use the GI Bill to supplement their income during their first year driving, as well as tuition reimbursement when they begin. Conway Truckload wants to continue the tradition of service right here at home. To learn more, call 866-WORK-FOR-US or visit online true2blue.com/military.
We're back on Veterans Radio in our final segment of today's program. We're talking with Bing West, noted author, security expert, counterterrorism person I love talking to because he always fills me in on what's really going on out there. We were talking earlier a little bit about what's been happening in Iraq, and you mentioned that Iran is now providing advisors to
and
the Iraqi,
soldiers.
And soldiers to the Iraqi army. Where do you see what's next with Iran? Are they going to be the ones that are going to take over, or are they just going to be isolated the way they are?
Oh, no. In Iraq, Iran has replaced American influence. Now, isn't that sad and ironic?
Yes.
We did all the heavy lifting, and now they're there. And, you know, I have generals telling me, well, Bing, you know, the Iraqis never really like the Iranians. Well, General, the Iraqis really don't like the Americans either. But the Iranians are there. They're helping them more. They live next door, and they're all Shia. So Iran has the upper hand relative to us, and therefore I don't understand our policy relative to Iraq. It is clear from the anger with which the president spoke in the last few days about any notion of putting any kind of threat of sanctions on Iran that he will do anything he possibly can to get some sort of deal with Iran so that he has something to say he prevented nuclear war or something when it's over, before he leaves office. And I'm afraid that he's just so desperate to get it that he's given away entirely too much. The fundamental principle of the United Nations was that you did not have the right to enrich uranium to the extent that it could only be used for nuclear bombs, not for nuclear energy. And he's already conceded that basic point without seeming to realize, and this is again where I don't understand the press, it's not just Iran. If you're Saudi Arabia, you're Turkey, you're Egypt, you watch, and they are going to do exactly what we let the Iranians do. And so you have a situation that is setting up to have nuclear proliferation among unstable states in the Middle East that will come to the fore about 10 to 15 years from now, because it doesn't happen, you know, quickly, but it'll get there. And this will be an enormous problem. And the fuse is being lit now. In my judgment, what you should do with Iran, because Saudi Arabia really is using oil as the weapon against Iran now.
Right.
Saudi Arabia is pumping oil. They're not pumping oil because they think that they can stop us from producing shale oil and having it here at home. They're pumping oil so that the price of oil stays so low that the Saudis can sustain it, but it puts more and more hurt upon Iran. And I think if we had stern sanctions that we were serious about, combined with the low price of oil, we could force the Iranians to make a fundamental decision. Do they want the nuclear weapon or do they want an economy? And unfortunately, I don't see the president being strong enough, because he just came right out and said he doesn't want sanctions because they'll interfere with the negotiations. No. Sanctions should be the leverage. He should be saying to the Iranians, hey, you've got to cut a deal with me because I have all these nuts in the Senate that are going to be much tougher on you.
That's true.
Yeah, that's how I'd play it if I were the president.
Well, maybe you should think about that.
He clearly has thought the other way for some reason.
No, I know that. Well, with what you're talking about with Iran, doing that to Iran, you know, and I don't know what your expertise is on Russia, but don't you see a similar, I mean, not the nuclear weapons part of it, but the idea of what they're doing to their economy. And, you know, what's Russia going to do? I mean, they, you know, when people are threatened to get in the corner, they do crazy things.
The last refuge of the scoundrel being patriotism. If you get stuck, you wave the flag and say we're under attack from someone else. I mean, that's what the crazy people down in Venezuela in charge of that nutty government have been doing. They're always saying, oh, the Americans are coming, the Americans are coming.
Mm-hmm.
With Putin, hopefully he's hit the high water mark with seizing Crimea and part of the Ukraine, and now his economy is going to be terribly hurt by the oil prices, but I don't see any particular way in which he gains anything by provoking an issue with Estonia or something. I could be proven wrong very quickly, but I don't really see that occurring.
Well, you know, we've been talking about a lot of different parts of the world here, and what you think may happen, and you know, some people are going to agree and some people are not going to agree. But I really appreciate your talking to us and kind of giving us a clearer picture of what's going on over there, because I don't see a whole lot of this in many of the newspapers that I read, and I'm pretty much what they used to call mainstream media, but I just don't see anybody, you know, writing a lot of these stories. I wanted to do a quick segue, though, because I wanted you to talk about your latest book and let people know that they can go to your website, which is westwrite.com, to find out more about you and your son, who is also an excellent writer. But tell me about this 1 million steps.
Well, I spent quite a bit of time in Afghanistan over the last couple of years just out with the platoons. And I wrote this book, 1 million Steps, so that people would understand what are our soldiers and Marines doing every day. And the reason I calculated 1 million steps, this platoon I was with, they went out on patrol every day for about 2.5 miles. They were there for 6 months, and I calculated this added up to about 1 million steps that they took in 6 months. And they started with 52. They had 3 killed, 9 amputations, and over a dozen gunshot wounds. So at the end, they only had 24 to 26 of the initial 52 that were still with them.
Wow.
And it was this. And what I tried to do in writing the book when I was out on patrol is get people to think, this is like you're on a golf course where there are a lot of geese, and you're supposed to walk every day for 2.5 miles, any place where there's a lot of geese in the field or something, but you're never to step into a goose poop. What are the odds you're going to do it every single day and never hit one of these IEDs?
Right. Right. Oh.
This corporal by the name of Yazzie, who was a full-blooded Navajo Indian, and he kept telling me, he said, you just stay behind me, you're not going to have any problem. On one patrol, he found 4 of them before any of them went off. And Yazzie found 38 as he was going on. We thought no one was in the class with Yazzie. But it even caught up to Yazzie. I try to indicate these are the young men we have fighting for us. We don't have a problem with the young men fighting for us. We have a problem with the clarity of our leaders telling us what the heck we're fighting for and what means victory.
Mm-hmm.
So in the book, I try to indicate this is what we were doing. But come on, General. Come on, Mr. President. Tell me, why are we doing it? What is the order that you would give to a corporal?
Right.
I believe that if the president or a general cannot give an order when you send somebody into battle, that the corporal understands and can say to you, sir, you told me to do this for this reason, and I understand it. If you can't give an order that is that clear, then your mind is not clear enough to be sending that corporal into battle.
That's a very important point, and we've talked to a lot of generals over the last 11 years that have talked about, you know, the idea of clarity of their orders, you know, because a general is probably 40 to 50 years old in most cases.
Right.
And they're down talking to a corporal or an E2 or E3 who is 18, 19 years old, and they want to follow your orders. That's what we're trained to do. And if they're not clear, we're just, you know, the 18, 19-year-old are going to start getting frustrated with those orders.
Well, the classic example was General McChrystal. It seems like a fine man, but his order made absolutely no sense. He told everyone, look, your mission is to win the hearts and minds of the people. They must be with you. And therefore, everything you do should be careful not to hurt any of the people. And if you can, when you're in a fight, and you feel you might have to use drop air or something, and they're in a house, and you don't know if there are civilians there, if you can withdraw, withdraw. Mm-hmm. Well, if I'm a corporal, and I listen to all that, I say, well, wait a minute, sir. I don't speak posture. How do I make a friend of a villager? How do I know he's my friend? What am I supposed to do? You hand me a rifle. You tell me to go out, but you tell me, be careful about killing the enemy lest you kill the civilians. Well, all of that is negative. What's the positive? Do you want me going out there to kill the enemy, or do you want me going out there with a hoe in my hand and helping till the fields and hope then that the farmer will do what? That he'll pick up the rifle and go out and kill the Taliban because he's my friend? You see what I mean? The orders from the top were good-hearted, but they were nuts. They made no sense to a man on the ground.
No, you go back 50 years and you're looking at winning the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese.
Exactly.
And look, I
was an advisor in Vietnam.
I
had a combined action platoon in the village. You know, I got along tremendously with the Vietnamese. But I wasn't there to hold their hands.
Mm-hmm.
I was there to kill the Viet Cong. And we got it all mixed up in Iraq and certainly in Afghanistan when we said, we had Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, saying, oh, we can't win this war by killing. Hello, yes you can. Every war is won by killing.
That's true. The minute
you're afraid to even say that, then you're in the wrong line of work.
We got about 3 minutes left, and my last question for you is, you know, the military is going to be having to go through some dramatic changes probably in the next 10 years. Where do you see it? You know, what do you think is going to happen to America's military over the next 10 years?
My biggest concern is very simple. We don't have the money. We talked about the debt. So we're not going to be giving more money to the military. At best, we're going to say the amount of money you have, which is now 3.5% of the gross domestic product, is what you're going to get. President Obama wants to bring it down to 1.2%, 7%, but I don't think he's going to be able to persuade the Congress to do it.
Mm-hmm.
However, just like we have Social Security, the military has manpower costs that no one has reined in. So the biggest problem I see 10 years from now with the military is their hardware is not going to be as technologically advanced as it should be. I see the biggest problem in the military being that we're not going to be able to modernize. That's the biggest problem.
Yeah, how do we stay ahead of the bad guys? Because
Well, the answer is we have to get a hold of manpower costs and pensions, the whole thing, just like we do in the civilian sector.
Because there was an article I was reading today in today's paper that was talking about, you know, that the encryption technology, I guess, for the internet and emails and all that other stuff is becoming so sophisticated on both sides that we are not able to intercept the bad guys' messages any longer. And that's one of the excuses, I guess, that they are using for not being able to find where all these bad guys are.
Well, I believe the overall thrust of that digital data and encryption is going to cost us much more money, and we are not ahead in that area. We're not ahead.
That's very true. Well, Bing West, I want to thank you again for being on Veterans Radio. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you and for you to give up your Sunday afternoon to talk to us here on Veterans Radio. We look forward to talking to you again. Courage our audience, go out to westwright.com. Any one of these books are great books, and you're gonna know a whole lot more about the world and a whole lot more about your military. Thanks very much, Bing.
Thank you, Dale.
Okay. So we've had Bing West on today. Next week we're going to be talking. Actually, we're going to be taking a little trip back to where?
Fallujah.
Back to Fallujah.
Battle of Fallujah. Vincent Falk, FLULK, the author. and we're going to be talking about, well, there's many battles of Fallujah. It's going to be very, very enlightening.
All right, we're going to go back to what happened 10 years ago. Just like today, we got to go.